Yeah, good evening. My name is Jeff Gostick. I'm from the Department of Chemical Engineering at McGill, and I'm going to talk about electrochemical energy storage, which has been alluded to a few times already. So I'll start by giving a real-world example of some large-scale energy storage that's being done electrochemically, and that is so-called green gas in Germany. So I was recently in Germany, and I was struck by the number of windmills that you can see when you're traveling around. So this is an image where you can see some windmills in the foreground, and perhaps you can see another row of windmills in the background, then another row of windmills beyond that, and pretty much as far as the eye can see. So there's a lot of wind power being generated. I think it's something like 40% at certain times. So there's a surplus power, of course, because we know the wind's blowing when we don't need it and so on. So the excess power is being given away to neighboring countries for free. So the solution is let's store this energy and use it. So I've color-coded that solution as green because that's a good idea. Second problem arises is that, okay, now how are we going to store this energy? How are we going to actually implement this idea? So geological energy storage, such as massive hydroelectric dams, are not available in Germany. So that's unfortunate. So, but there's no other readily available or commercially viable storage technologies other than water splitting to make hydrogen. So electrolysis is an old technology, and it's commercially viable and so on. So they're splitting water to make hydrogen. So I've colored that orange because that's a little suboptimal. It has a high energy, low energy efficiency. So that's orange in its quality of solution. And finally, where do you put this hydrogen? There's no hydrogen infrastructure. Hydrogen storage tanks are expensive. So where is this hydrogen going to go? Well, the answer is to let's inject it into our natural gas pipelines that we have crisscrossing our country. And that is a red solution because it's a waste of hydrogen. It's like pouring champagne into a hydroelectric dam to raise its level. You know, it's not a good use of hydrogen. You can do much more efficient things with it. But it works. So natural gas end users can tolerate 5% hydrogen in their fuel without noticing any difference in performance or properties or so on. So it's working, they're doing that, but obviously there is a need to do something a little bit better. So we'll probably see this slide 6 times, one for each speaker, but here is the problem. When you have your house connected directly to a windmill, the windmill stops blowing, stops producing power, but your house doesn't stop demanding power. So on the top left is the blue is the power output from the windmill, and on the right is the electricity demand on the house. So this is not going to match when you overlay these two things. You're going to have blackouts and so on. So the solution is to fill a battery-shaped black box somewhere between the windmill and the house. And this will allow the wind power profile and the house demand profile to be able to match by charging the battery as needed when the wind is blowing, draining the battery when the house needs to, a little extra power, and so on. So that the output of the windmill appears to match the demand of the house. So that's the plan. Put some intermediate buffer between these two beginning and end of this power system. I've created a set of rules for joules for this talk. I started brainstorming what are the important things to think about for energy storage, and I have 6 of them. And 7 and higher will maybe be discussed tomorrow. There was mentioned in the introduction that there's a workshop tomorrow, and we'll all put our minds together, perhaps expand this list. But I will go over these 6. I'm not going to go over them right now because we're going to talk about them one at a time. So firstly, location, location, location. So the poster child for energy storage is hydroelectric reservoirs. And, of course, it's quite simple. When you have excess energy, you just run some pumps to put water uphill. And when you need it, you let the water go downhill and operate your dam as normal. So this is great. There's no nasty chemicals. Pumps can be run very efficiently. Everything works just great. The dams are already in place. The trouble is it's not possible in most places. So that violates, the location. There's another aspect of location as well. And that is that if you compare where the wind, in this instance I'm showing the wind generation in America versus the population density in the bottom right, the wind is not being generated anywhere near where the people are. So you have to get the energy to them over long, long distances sometimes. So if the wind happens to be blowing very hard and the demand in New York City also happens to be very high, that's great, except you still can't pipe the energy to them directly because the transmission system might not be able to take it. So you still need, even though you have a magical match between the demand and the supply, you still can't use it necessarily. Also, you can't necessarily pump that energy to a hydroelectric reservoir that's far away because, again, the same problem. You can't surge a whole bunch of energy through these transmission lines. So the solution is to store your energy locally at the windmill. And electrochemical energy storage, as in the form of batteries and other things, is location neutral. So often most, you know, so when you have location issues, the electrochemical energy storage is your only option. Rule two, this would probably be the main one, is to decouple storage and generation. So the question is, would you rather heat your house with a stove made of wood or a wood stove? So this is, you know, meant to be a joke, of course. You would not heat your house with a wooden stove. You would be able to do that one time and the stove would be gone. However, on the right, you, of course, have a massive pile of wood that can be replenished and depleted at will, and the wood stove will survive, and you can constantly, you've decoupled your heat generation and your heat storage. So we do the same thing with batteries. You can have a flow of batteries. So if you take copper top batteries, they look something like this inside, and I'll talk about the internals a little bit in a moment. But if you want more energy storage, you need more batteries. And once the battery is depleted, the fuel is gone, and the casing that does the reaction is also gone, so you have to bring in more batteries. The alternative to having a flow of batteries is to have a flow battery. And this, if you could imagine your battery that was, say, the internal reactants were liquid, you could pump them through in a cycle. And if you want more storage, you just increase the size of your tanks. So this is the concept of a flow battery. Let's take the reacting chemicals out of the power generating device and store them externally. And then you've decoupled the storage and the generation. So this is a familiar concept, of course, because it's the one we use, A, for our wood stove and also for our car. So the gas tank is the storage and the engine is the generation. So we've decoupled that successfully already. So it's not exactly rocket science to do this. But it's worth pointing out that this technology wasn't developed by NASA in the 70s. So it is actually rocket science. Third rule, the process must be reversible, highly reversible. So again, I'll compare the copper top battery. If you were to look inside one of these batteries with a microscope, you would see solid zinc particles, shiny zinc metal sitting in there in a porous electrode. And as the battery is depleted, the zinc dissolves into a liquid electrolyte and it's gone. It can't be returned. And the zinc particles themselves disappear like a sugar cube dissolving. You cannot recover this battery because the zinc has nowhere to go when you want to recharge it. The rechargeable batteries that we do know are lithium ion batteries work in a similar way. You have a solid electrode with little chunks of material in there, but instead of the material dissolving, lithium is embedded in the material. And as you run the battery, the lithium leaves the structure out into the electrolyte in exactly the same way, but the structure remains so that when you charge it, the lithium can go back into the structure. The template is there. So the shelf that you put the lithium there on, it remains. So it is highly reversible, and that's great, but of course lithium-ion batteries still suffer from the problem of not decoupling the storage and the generation. So, and the flow battery in this situation, the liquid contains the reactive species in a liquid form, which flows through the cell, comes up to a solid surface, grabs or releases an electron, and then just continues on its way through the cell and into the outlet tank. And when you want to recycle this thing, you just turn the pumps in the other direction, and you pump that spent fuel, which in this case is B, back through, and then turn it back into A. So it's highly reversible. The solid phase, the solid electrode is not involved at all, so there's very, you know, excellent degradation or very high degradation potentially. Degradation tolerance, pardon me. Now, rule four, size does not matter generally because we're talking about stationary applications. So just to divert for a second, when we talk about cars, size matters a lot. So we have this plot called a Ragone plot where you can plot different energy and power sources by their energy and power density. So on the vertical axis is the power, which is equivalent to the horsepower of your engine. And on the bottom axis is the energy, which is kind of equivalent to the range of your car. So you want to be at the top right of this thing, and that is where gasoline-powered cars live. It's because gas is very energy intense, and internal combustion engines are very powerful. So when you're talking about replacing fossil fuels in cars, you have to look at this plot and say, well, you know, lithium-ion batteries aren't very good there. They're not even, this is a log scale too, by the way. I mean, anyway, so it's even worse than it looks. So hydrogen fuel cells are there, technically speaking, and as was mentioned commercially, they're not cheap enough yet, but that's why there's such an interest in hydrogen fuel cells, is because they're competitive on this chart to actually make transportation work. Now, getting to the point, size does not matter for stationary applications because Most of these things are going to be in remote locations, arid deserts for solar power, or rough terrain for wind power, or so on. So you can put a large installation of flow batteries in this field, and nobody will really mind. So size doesn't matter, but cost does matter. So we can make the same sort of plot, but instead of comparing it as size density, let's compare it more of a size per cost. So on the x-axis, let's talk about the power per dollar, and on the vertical axis, talk about power per dollar, and on the bottom axis, the energy per dollar. So this is the same two things now, but I'm just talking about cost instead of the weight. So putting gasoline on this chart would look something like this. So I guess the bottom axis would be kind of the cost of the chemicals, and the vertical axis would be the cost of the equipment used to do the conversion. So gasoline we'll put on here somewhere just as a reference. This is completely qualitative, by the way. And let's put pumped hydro up there since, it's the poster child. So it would have very cheap chemicals, being water, which is essentially free. And even though a hydroelectric dam would be quite expensive to build, it's very powerful. So the ratio ends up being quite high. And also another thing to think about is that their durability is extremely high, so they last a century perhaps if maintained properly. So you get a lot of cycles out of that electric dam. So even though it's very expensive, it is good on the vertical axis. So now let's put the hydrogen splitting technology that they're using in Germany, the raw material being water, so it's equivalent to hydro in that respect, but it's much, much lower on this axis because the device requires platinum to work, and it is a very expensive device. Lithium-ion batteries are not going to be as cheap on the bottom axis as a high electrolyzer because you have the expensive chemicals in there and metals and so on. It's not going to be as cheap as water. And it's also going to be more expensive on the y-axis than electrolyzers because you have to make many, many batteries when you want to increase your power. So it's very poor in that regard. And finally, flow batteries have the potential to move up and over on this axis with engineering and technological breakthroughs. There's nothing stopping it from approaching gasoline in terms of the cost. It'll never approach it, at least the technologies we have on the radar today will never approach it in terms of weight, but it could approach it in terms of cost. So it's potentially very cheap, that's why a lot of people are talking about it for large-scale energy storage. And rule six, don't create new problems, but don't solve an old problem by creating a new one. And Francois mentioned that some of the environmental hazards of electrochemical energy storage. So I've drawn these two nice tanks filled with this arbitrary chemical, but these things could be potentially quite nasty. So when you're deciding which chemicals to put in these two tanks, the periodic table is at your disposal, more or less. So the iron chromium one at the top, so there's two chemicals involved. Some of them, one can be fine, and one of them can be nasty, and I've color-coded them. So the iron chromium would not be good because chromium is bad, so you wouldn't want that tank to leak into your water table and pollute your water supply with chromium. The vanadium battery is very popular because it has vanadium on both sides, and it's convenient for academics to study, but I don't think it's a good idea. Vanadium is very toxic. Lead, as we all know, is toxic, so there's these lead batteries. I don't think we should be using lead. As you move down, hydrogen is a safe gas. It's explosive, but so is propane and gasoline, and we deal with those just fine. So the hydrogen bromine cell is an option, and the bromine on the one side. Bromine is not all that toxic, but it's not going to be a replacement for olive oil or anything like that. So, color-coded that orange. As we move down, there's been a recent development from them using a quinone, which is a fancy kind of hydrocarbon molecule that has no valuable chemicals at all. It just has standard hydrocarbon things in it. So the raw materials are extremely cheap. So it has the potential to do amazing things. And it is, let's call that green because it doesn't have any heavy metals in it. And the report that made this discovery used bromine as one side, but they hinted that they could potentially use quinones on both sides. So that has a tremendous potential. So things are definitely moving in the right direction in this regard. And I'll just say at the end, I've also put hydrogen and air. This is the fuel cell that people have been talking about for a couple of decades now that it's going to go in cars. And it's green for sure on both sides. It's very environmentally benign technology. So that's why it's so appealing. That concludes my talk, and I'd like to thank everybody involved.